quit. But and then there was some crossover. You know, it wasn't necessarily they were, you know, they isolated themselves as Democrats, because Paul Robeson was a Republican, and Paul was, in fact, he was one of the guys I asked for a job when I came here. And then it was Robeson Moody,
Kay Robeson
Moody, yeah, right. And I think that firm had just broken up, and Wendell had moved to his own office there on 4th Avenue. And Paul was at least using an office there in Judge Moody's office. So, and they were all, you know, good friends, and they, you know, worked well together.
Was there a split as far as people who'd been here for a certain amount of time staying together? People like Manders and two of the other old-timers?
People who'd been here for a while? Yeah, well, like Harold Butcher. John Manders, Ray Plummer, Judge Plummer. What do you mean? It was split. Did they hold themselves apart from the others? Not at all. George Grigsby. No, I don't.
You
mean more modern? How do you mean?
Some people have said that probably around 1952, 53, 54, there was a new crop of lawyers that came in.
Oh, yes, yes.
And that crop of lawyers were better trained than a lot of the older people who've never been to law school, and that sort of thing.
Well, let's see, a lot of these older fellows had been to law school, all right. Stanley had, and he read law in Grigsby's office, as I understood. But Davis and Renfrew and Hughes, they'd all been to law school. John Hughes came with the firm with Davis and Renfrew in 51. John had been to law school. I sort of have the impression, and I may be absolutely wrong, that the class before our class, which I think had John Rader, Gordon Hartlieb, Cliff Groh, Bucklew, Talbot, some of those, it was sort of the beginning of that change, where you had the younger lawyers came to town in a little larger numbers, and it's not that they were any better lawyers than because these guys, you know, Davis and Renfrew and Hughes were all good lawyers, and John Dunn was a good lawyer, and Dan Cuddy was a good lawyer, and George Grigsby was an excellent criminal lawyer, and the new guys. I don't know whether things changed or was any different. The practice was any different, or not. You know, it's hard to judge, of course. But I kind of had the feeling that sort of the tempo of practice was picking up, and that may be entirely in here. You know, I suppose it's easy to assume that when you show up, why everything changes, but it may not well be the case.
Did you put yourself in that group of
Grom,
Rader, Talbot?
Atkinson. I was in the next class, the next year's class, I believe. I think they were the class the year before us in taking the bar. I would suppose so. I don't know, except for the fact that maybe there was more, that maybe these two groups that were admitted to the bar at that time were more in number. And so you had a group of young, hungry lawyers who were reasonably capable, all coming into the community at one time. And
were they more aggressive business-wise, would you say?
I suspect that's true. I don't know that to be a fact necessarily. I look back at some of the fellows that were, you know, preceding them, and, you know, aggressive, kind of business people. You know, Harold Butcher, excellent lawyer. by anybody's book. And Davis and Renfrew and Hughes, good lawyers, tended to business, and took good care of their clients. So it's difficult to say. I'm not sure that, the more I talk about it, I'm not sure that change took place there.
Maybe it was a matter of numbers. Maybe it was a matter of...
I think that was more it than anything else, really. It perhaps became more visible, you know. And perhaps the style changed a little bit by virtue of these people being a large group of younger people. Perhaps their styles
were
different. Well, I don't know that it did change, but I say perhaps it did. Perhaps they were a little more aggressive than otherwise, than the practice had been. I don't know. I'm not certain that there was any change at all. The more I think about it, you know.
In the early years, I would think that the practice had changed too. There were only a couple firms per se.
Mm-hmm.
Davis and Renfrew was one that sticks out.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly in the '50s, you're getting Hartley, Grow, and Rader, K. Robinson,
mm-hmm.
and Moody.
Mm-hmm.
Although they're pretty much old timers by that time.
There was some of that, more firms, I suppose, starting up. It was Plummer and Arnell in the early days, Plummer and Arnell, Ed Arnell and Ray Plummer, and Davis and Renfrew, and then it was Davis, Renfrew, and Hughes, and then Hartley, Grow, and Rader. Gordon was a United States commissioner, a very good United States commissioner. We had some real good judges in that commissioner's court, guys that were, in my estimation, and they have proved to be outstanding lawyers. Ken Atkinson, a darn good judge, and Gordon Hartley, Bill Moran, that's about it.
What did you do after your time with John Dunn? Did you work with John Manders?
Went with John Manders, and I worked for John right shortly after the first of the year in 1955. And worked for John, who was a great guy, just a prince of a fellow, capable lawyer, intelligent man, very pleasant to work with, very kind. I recall I was admitted when I was in John's office, and so John was involved in a large bond case involving a construction project controversy. And he was back east. And John's secretaries thought that John could walk on water with no difficulty at all, and that myself was by far the junior lawyer in many respects, first of which was an ability. And so... John was gone, and we had a client come in. Bill Kelsey? And it was the Kelsey from Valdez. And they had a dock down at Valdez. K-E-L-S-E-Y, I think. In fact, I think it was referred to as the Kelsey dock. And Manders was gone, and apparently Manders had done work for this fellow, Kelsey. And a ship was there taking on a load of scrap. It was the rails from the old railroad that ran from up into the Kennecott area. And somehow or another they banged into the dock and sheared off some fender piling or some daggone thing. And anyway, they were loading up and they were getting up steam and getting ready to go. And, it was a foreign vessel, Panamanian registry, 15 nationalities in the crew, but they were actually under a charter by some outfit out of New York, I think. And so this guy calls up on the phone and Manders is gone. Well, who had anybody else help? Well, we got the kid here. He can talk to you. Okay, so I talked to him, you know. Big Admiralty lawyer. Learned more Admiralty there than I ever learned. But so he told me the problem, and I started pulling down books and looking and studying and getting the statute out, and, you know, just a flurry of activity. And the secretaries were becoming very apprehensive because they were afraid that I was going to do something that was going to embarrass Mr. Manders. Well, I can't fault them for that, but in any event, I was going and I was getting secretaries organized, and they were saying, well, don't you think you should call Mr. Manders? And I said, no, I don't think I should call Mr. Manders, and kept going. Let's get this bond made up and all this sort of thing. And I had form books all over the place, the USCA and whatnot, and they kept bugging me, you know, and that typewriter started slowing down, so I said, well, all right, if you insist, get him on the phone for me, you know. So, pretty soon, here's Manders on the phone, and they were explaining this to him, so. Okay, Mr. Manders wants to talk to you. And so, John's on the phone. He says, what's going on? So I told him. I said, I'm doing such. He says, sounds good to me. See you later. Bye. That was the end of that. And the typewriters resumed speed, and away we went. And we got the marshal organized and was going to put a plaster on that vessel. And lo and behold, I got a call from a local lawyer saying, I understand you're about to grab our vessel. I said, you better believe it. So he posted a bond. That was the end of that. No international incidents or anything. But John was like that. He was very good that way. Very good. And he was, you know, he was one of the favorite, my favorite lawyers in my practice.
What kind of cases did he normally handle? Did he get a lot of
animal? No, not all that much. A lot of commercial type work, some insurance defense, some fire work. I tried a fire case. The first case I tried, where I could prepare it, was a fire case that had been in Manders' office and was transferred to me when I left. When I went down to Davis and Renfrew, Davis, Renfrew, and Hughes, the case was transferred down there, and I took it over. And but, you know, John did that sort of work. Probate, commercial work, that sort of thing. No criminal work. John had nothing to do with that sort of thing.
How long did you spend with him?
I was there till about mid-year, till about June, maybe June or July. Went across the hall to Paul Robinson's office.
Wild the travel from one office.
Yeah, oh yes. I just started going into one door in the morning and went and started going into the other one.
Yeah.
And
why did you leave John Manders' office?
Oh, John didn't give me enough work to do, I suppose. And the pay wasn't going any place. And I was still, I think, at 400 or so a month.
What were fees like?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't have too much experience in charging fees in those days. Because for most of my work, John would set the fee. And when I was working for Robinson, he'd kind of set the fee.
Did you know what the fees were when they were being set by them?
I don't think I did. I don't think I did. And till December 30th, 1955.
This is the 6 months
stint. Right.
What did you do for them?
Well, over there was Paul had a fairly active real estate practice, mm-hmm. and some general commercial type practice. And I remember we got into a deal where somehow or another, I don't know where it came from, I guess it was a Republican political favor, that Robinson was designated as the attorney to foreclose on a bunch of mortgages on a housing project out here that had kind of gone sour. I think it was FHA or something, government lending. I remember we had this cardboard box full of mortgages. But the government said they wanted us to do these foreclosures for $25 a piece. So Paul asked me if we couldn't work out some sort of a form that we could do these at for $25 a piece. And I looked at that and I said, Paul, there is no way in the world that we can do these for $25 a piece without losing our shirt. But he sent me back to the drawing board a number of times. I went back to the drawing board and I always came up with this. Oh, we had a labor case. Paul represented the Ford dealer. No, when I left, they were still in the box, wherever they should remain. But, no, I never did do it. But we got an interesting labor case. Paul represented the Ford dealer here at that time. And there was a strike and picketing and all that sort of thing. Kind of interesting. Well, as I recall, well, that's what it was. The dealer, the Ford dealer, had an arrangement with these employees where they were strictly piecework employees. So the harder they worked, the more money they made. And it was a fascinating thing to me because these fellows, I talked with them in the course of this litigation. And they were quite happy with their plight. And they would buy their own tools and so they could work faster and do more and make more money. And they were making great money, much better than union scale, actually. But the union, that bothered them a little bit. So the union tried to organize and I think got an election to be held. Well, the union got one vote. The car washer, and he wasn't on piecework. He was working by the hour. And all the rest of them voted against it. Said, no. Well, then the union said, okay, we're going to put up a picket line around your place. The idea, it's educational picketing. We want to get these guys to join the union because it's for their own good. And so we were trying to knock that picket line down. Unsuccessfully, I might add. And I did some research, and this Ford dealer had some connection with Spokane, Washington. There was a fellow down there who was a big labor lawyer on management side. And Dick Axtell, I think was his name. And very...
How do you spell that?
Probably Axtell, something like that. And he had a... I remember he had a service in Spokane where a number of people throughout the state would call him for quick answers. And he was a very capable fellow. I did all this research in the United States Supreme Court cases. I was coming up with answers I didn't like, but it sure sounded like it to me. And so then this expert came to town and he read over my research memorandums. And he said, yep, that's the law. So I felt better. At least I'd found the law. And that was the end of that. We didn't sue the union, didn't try to join the picketing. And that was all.
Why did you leave Robinson at the end of the year?
Oh, for one thing, I had a better offer. Mr. Hughes... we had come in contact when I was studying for the bar exam. I was in the law library in the federal building, the old federal building, on a Sunday. And I was working and studying and all that sort of thing. And Mr. Hughes was in the law library working on a brief in a criminal case that he had inherited from Mr. Renfrew. And one of the problems in the case was that this pimp had been convicted on the testimony of a girl who was working for him in the nature of an accomplice. And so thus there was uncorroborated the uncorroborated testimony question. And it just happened that I had read a law review article in the University of Michigan Law Review, which was lying out there on the table. And John and I started discussing this question, or I asked John what he was doing, and he said, well, I'm writing this brief, and I got this question. I said, gosh, so, you know, I just read a law review article on that. And you know, he wrote his brief for him. And so we became acquainted. And then one time in the fall of 55, I was at a, about after the time I changed to Robson's office, not long after that. Well, that's not true. It was later in the year. And so I was at a Republican meeting. John's a Republican. And he came over to me and he says, the hell did you tell somebody when you're going to change jobs? Well, I said, I didn't know you were interested. Well, he says, might be. Well, I said, I'm still available. Well, let's talk. Okay, so we talked. And I called him, went out to his house, and had a cup of coffee with he and his wife. I did. And so he said, well, I'll be in touch with you. So he called me up and made me an offer. I couldn't refuse. $600 a month. And
what did you get earning?
So I think five, maybe six. Maybe six. So the offer was that I should come to work for them on January 2, 1956. And so I went and talked to Paul as to, you know, what my future was there. And in talking with Paul, I got the impression that Paul was not interested in taking partners and that he was much more interested in a sole practitioner. And he was, at that time, he wasn't too long out of K. Robinson Moody, which I get the impression was not a very happy experience for one reason or another. So he said he wasn't interested in taking on any partners, and that sort of situation I wasn't interested in staying, so I wrapped it up and went to work for Davis Renfrew and Hughes on January 2, 1956. Haven't dared leave since.
Who was with Davis Renfrew and Hughes, right? And Thorsten.
It became Davis, Renfrew, Hughes, and Thorsness in 1957. And
so
then...
It took 1 year for you to become a partner.
Right, right. They recognized ability. And Bill Renfrew then retired in the fall of 57. I think it was the fall of 57. Mm-hmm. And...
why did he retire?
Oh, I'm not sure. I was a little concerned. It might have been because I made partner, but I don't think that was the case at all, because Bill and I got along very, very well. I thought a great deal of him and really enjoyed him. And he had, wasn't publicized much, but Bill had a heart problem, I think. And I think he had probably a little more of a heart problem than he was willing to admit to, because when he retired in the fall of 57, he pretty well quit practicing law. And he started again later, but he pretty well quit practicing law at that time. Mm-hmm. So then it was Davis, Hughes, and Thorsness.
What kind of cases did you handle it? First started out
as
Davis Renfrew and Hughes.
Well, I started out doing some insurance defense work, mostly in the area of automobile, although I got the head of a substantial fire case for a fire insurance, series of fire insurance companies defending, and some commercial work, some drawing of documents. I was assigned the task of some rather high-powered clients. Ed Davis was up at the convention, the Constitutional Convention, and Renfrew was shooting tigers in India, and Hughes was holding down the fort, and he didn't have any time to take care of these guys, so he told me to take care of them. And they were people who were very, very well known in the community, so you might say leaders in the community, and I was a little apprehensive. And so they came in, and we sat down and talked about it, and I took notes. They got all through, and this one guy says, do you think you know what we want to do? I said, I think I've got an idea. And he said, good, because he said, I'm not sure I know. So I said, well, I'll draft an agreement and come back in tomorrow morning to look at it. Okay, I draft an agreement, give it to him the next morning. They read it over, and they said, yeah, that sounds like what we want to do. And so we drew the agreement, and signed it up, and they were very happy, and we're all very good friends ever since. So, you know, that sort of commercial work, little criminal work for Renfrew, because Renfrew handled criminal work, some divorce work, because Renfrew handled divorce work. And
did Davis and Renfrew split up different areas of practice?
They did different areas of practice. Mm-hmm. Bill Renfrew did a lot of, as I say, a lot of divorce work, some criminal work. Bill was a very good traveler, excellent traveler, intuitive type person. You know, I'd watch him in trial, and he'd there'd be some evidence that was offered, and he'd jump up and object, and he you'd listen for the grounds, and he'd keep talking, and he really wasn't stating what the appropriate grounds were. But he'd say enough so that the judge would get the idea of what the grounds were. And because he just had an intuitive sense about him in the evidentiary field, evidence field. And so he was very capable. And he, as I say, did criminal work, divorce work. So I inherited some of that from Bill, because Bill was, he liked to fish and hunt. Chase girls and fly around the countryside. He enjoyed that much better than the mundane aspects of practicing law.
Did it cause any resentment back at the office that here you were back doing all the cases and he's off having fun?
Not that I was aware of. There may have been some, but they got along pretty well. Davis, right?
Did Davis take time off?
Yeah, he took some time off. The Davises had a even, you know, that early, they had a home in Hawaii. And they would go down to Hawaii. In fact, for a couple years, Diet, Ed's wife, would take the kids to Hawaii in the fall and stay there all year. And Ed would come down in the wintertime sometime and maybe spend a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And Ed was a hard worker. Ed, he, you know, he was always in the office at 7:30 in the morning, and he'd work till, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock at night, and very hard, conscientious, a more conscientious man you couldn't find, and a good, kind, pleasant fellow, you know, good-natured. He wouldn't speak a harsh word to anybody, regardless of what they did to him. And
when you joined the firm, you'd been with other solo practitioners and kind of had a feel for what was happening with the practice in Alaska. Did you get a sense when you joined that firm that it was going to be a firm that just kept on growing and going, that it wasn't going to be, you didn't have any sense
of
that kind of thing?
No.
What kind of sense did you get from the firm?
I sensed that there was a lot of work to do. And it was really, when I was working for Paul, I didn't have that much work to do. When I was working for Manners, I had less work to do. When I was working for Dunn, I was, you know, such a neophyte that I couldn't do very much. And he was busy and didn't have all that much time to instruct me. So I went to work for Davis, Renfrew, and Hughes, and I sat down at my desk on January 2nd, and Mr. Hughes came in with a stack of files and put them on my desk and said, okay, you said you were a lawyer, now prove it, mm-hmm. and walked out the door, and that was the end of that. So I was, it was a sink or swim operation, and I managed to escape ulcers, premature gray hair, all that sort of thing. I suppose just by working, because I worked hard. And John and I both worked hard. Ed did too. Ed Davis did too, of course. And we worked damn hard and just dig, I'm sure I learned more about the practice of the law in my first 5 years of practice, particularly when I started with the firm, the first 5 years with the firm, I learned more about the practice of law than I ever learned. And it was largely by simply working. We worked in the summertime, we worked, I think, 5.5 days a week. We worked till noon on Saturday. In the wintertime, we worked 6 days a week, and lots of times in the evenings. And when Ed went on the, then Bill, of course, retired, and then Ed went on the bench in 59, and so it was just John and I. And I'll tell you, 59 and 60, we worked days, nights, Saturdays, Sundays, holidays. I'll tell you, you know, when we weren't in the office, it was a damned exception. And
why didn't you hire another associate?
I really don't know. It didn't seem to occur to us, I guess. But, well, that isn't entirely true either, because, you see, this statehood came upon us, I think, rather abruptly. And Davis's being appointed a judge came on us rather abruptly. Perhaps if we'd have stopped and considered it, we would have said, well, Ed's probably going to want to be a judge, and he'll probably be appointed, because he was a Democrat. And Bill Egan, of course, was Democrat. And so, but we didn't. And as a result, I suppose we were perhaps caught napping. And but then I was trying to think when we hired Bob Lowe. I think it was in 61, 62, somewhere in there. Hired Bob. And then maybe a year or so after that, we hired Murphy Clark. And maybe a year or so after that, or maybe not that long, I hired Dick Gantz. And everybody else's practice, I suppose, had the same problem of converting over to the state system, where we had what? Coupa.
Judges?
Yeah. Judge Cooper. Who was the judge? Oh, Davis, of course. And Cooper. And Fitzgerald. It was any more than that the first time around or not? You know, right out of the chute in statehood. Three very good judges. Yeah. And then, of course, at the same time, we had a federal judge. And before, we had one judge in Anchorage. Occasional visiting judges. So, our trial activity wasn't all that great. All of a sudden, we have three Superior Court judges who were gung-ho to get cases moving, setting cases for trial. I tried five cases one time, back-to-back. Try one, give it to the jury, go next door, start the next one, verdict come in, you recess, go get the verdict, come back, try that one, same way. Five cases, back-to-back. Great sport. Really enjoyed it.
Have you ever got ulcers?
Not a bit. No. Very bit.
What about the other lawyers in town? Was it hard for them to adapt to statehood, the ones who've been here for so long?
Oh, I don't think so. I saw no evidence of that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, the transition, it was a welcome transition. We had some good judges. Davis, Fitzgerald, you know, good judges. And so you'd go to court, get motions heard, and they started insisting at that time on filing a memorandum with some case citations in it. Used to be able to do that, get a memorandum, you know, argument, you know. I think I ought to win because I think I ought to win, you know. You know. And so I think the tone of the practice, the quality of the practice changed on statehood considerably, because we really turned the corner and started, at least in the trial practice where I was, why it really got, you know, really, really was a change.
Is it because the judges demanded more of the lawyers?
Yeah, sure.
And that's what it was?
Sure.
So the judges really changed the practice more than anything else?
I think that's true. The trial practice.
The trial
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What about the civil?
Didn't change all that much, because I was doing commercial work and trial work. You know, at the same time, I wasn't exclusively occupied with trial work as I am now. And
your commercial work, did that change with statehood?
Not really. I suppose if it changed at all, it changed only in tempo, in quantity. There was more commercial activity right after statehood.
The court bar fight, what happened? Just as far as the tenor of the situation, was it part of the transition or something? You were on the board of governors at the time.
Yeah. Well, my own personal view is that some very strong, to the point of being stubborn, personalities got involved.
On both sides.
On both sides, absolutely. And emotions ruled where reason should have.
What were the personalities on the bar side?
You mean the people?
Yeah.
Well, George Boney, Harold Butcher, Ed Boyko, John Connolly, I think, was involved. Harold Stringer, I think, was involved.
In the court bar fight?
I think so. I'm not sure about that now.
I think he was gone.
Yeah. Stringer was? Or Connolly?
Stringer. I think he was elected about 60.
Yeah, I think maybe you're right. I think you're right. I think Connolly was involved.
Mm-hmm.
Who else would have been involved in that?
Was Kay?
Yes, Arendo was involved. I'm sure he was.
How about Neil McKay?
I don't think Neil, particularly. Yeah, perhaps peripherally. I think maybe Roger Cremo was, somewhat. well, Roger was part and parcel of that deal where they got the marshal or the police officer to pull a gun on the teller. But
why were people like Butcher and Boyko and why were they so?
Well, interestingly enough, a number of those people had been very good, pretty good friends of the Chief Justice Nesbitt when he was in practice. Although, as I recall, Buell was a little bit of a loner in practice. A very capable fellow, intelligent fellow. He had other problems, but nevertheless, he was, I think, recognized as a pretty good lawyer, quality one. And some of these guys, like Wendell, had been active in passing the Integrated Bar Act in the state in the territorial legislature, and they didn't want anybody to take it over. And there was a little, they had a lot of influence in the state bar as to what was done and what wasn't done. Well, I don't know exactly, but it's kind of hard to define at this point. But I imagine some of it in the grievance area, how much grievances were pushed, that sort of thing. These guys were political animals. You know, they thought in terms of politics. In the Bar Association, they not so much in Democratic and Republican politics, but they thought more in the sense of control and organization and that sort of thing. And then along came the Chief Justice and said, "I'm going to take over the Bar Association," and they didn't want any part of that. And about that time, the wagon separated because a fellow who had been there previously been, I think, their friend, no longer their friend. And it became kind of a bitter fight.
Was it a power play on both sides?
I wouldn't term it a power play. I think, my own personal opinion, is that Nesbitt thought the bar wasn't doing what it ought to be doing. Just what that was, I'm not sure. Or I can't recall. And so his efforts to take over the Bar Association, in a sense, when I say take it over, I'm not sure that's perhaps a little too broad.
Take over the disciplinary procedure.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think it was that he wanted to take over the Bar Association in a power sense, in the sense that he would control everything. But I think it was more in the area of he wanted to ensure that the Bar Association did what it was supposed to do, particularly in the disciplinary field. And I think some of the guys who were just adamantly opposed to him perhaps were a little apprehensive in that regard, rightly or wrongly. There was, of course, at and about that time, a rather sticky, wicked disciplinary proceeding involving Neil McKay. And that kind of got into it a little bit, too, I think. So, and the people in the bar were interested in maintaining their autonomy. This was sort of the watchword. Glenn Winters, who was the executive director of the American Judicature Society and a good friend of Ed Davis, was, I think, summoned or invited by Ed Davis to lend his offices to a solution to this problem. He came up here. And he called a meeting. And I think I was the immediate past president. And I'm not sure, but I think Gene Wiles was president. And somebody else, I forget who it was now. And the Chief Justice, we had a dinner meeting over here at the Westward. And I thought we really made a lot of progress. I thought I saw a change in the Chief Justice. At least I thought partially because of the international, the national organization being involved. I thought I saw an indication of a willingness to compromise, to perhaps change the situation. I think that was on a Friday night. And Saturday morning we had a meeting at the Elks Club, the old Elks Club over here. And we, question was then whether or not I think the bar was going to retain counsel and sue the Chief Justice, et cetera, et cetera. And I went to that meeting and I argued against doing it, but it was quite clear by these people that spoke that they were committed in their own mind to war, and war we did. So,
were these the same people you mentioned before?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Harold, Bowie, Blanco.
I
don't remember whether Wendell was involved in that much in it or not, at least out front. Oh, they were, I suppose you would say, they were sort of on the fringe, you might say. That is, they were on the sort of, they weren't actively speaking. They weren't actively pushing it. Although I think they were lending their support to the movement. Because I think they felt that they didn't want Nesbitt taking over the Bar Association either. I think, you know, I don't think anybody wanted Nesbitt taking over the Bar Association. Not sure Nesbitt wanted to take over the Bar Association. On the contrary, I suspect, in reality, he wanted things to get for the Bar Association to do their job. And I'm not sure they were doing such a great job at that time, as far as disciplinary proceedings were concerned.
Where were the judges, the new judges, where were they standing on this whole?
I think very quietly. They weren't involved. They really couldn't get involved at that point.
Was it uncomfortable for them? Were they being asked to lend?
Oh, I don't think so. At least.
Were the Juno lawyers involved with the court bar fight?
I don't recall they were.
Juno was president for a while of the bar, at least.
Yeah.
Did he have any sway over the members, or was he among?
I don't, well, you know, once again, he may have been, but it may have been quietly, or it may have been simply in conversation, or what he might be able to do in the legislature, or something of this, but I don't recall Bob being, you know, certainly he was not at the big indignation.